Have your say in ExchangeWise Industry Review APAC, our in-depth view of the hottest issues impacting the region. Comment on one of six topics: walled gardens, gaming, retail media, the service layer, the open web and CTV, and join ExchangeWire in driving the industry forward. Email info@exchangewire.com to get involved.
The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast, our weekly dive into the world of media, marketing and commerce. I'm Hannah Dillon, staff writer at ExchangeWire, and this week I'm joined by ExchangeWire COO and natural enemy to all birds of prey, Lindsay Roundtree. Hi, Lindsay.
Brilliant.
I thought I'd share an interesting fact about you.
That was not what I expected, Hannah Dillon. Wow. And it's not birds of prey. It's anything with wings, basically. Really evident over the past few days. I had to walk through a wasp's nest recently. And,
Oh,
the panic attack ensued. And the embarrassment from all the people around me. Yes. So anything with wings. I do like a bird of prey, just not particularly near me. Pigeons I'm terrified of. So, yeah. Thank you for sharing that with the world.
Yeah, no problem. No worries. I thought, you know, really what's missing from this podcast is people don't know the people behind the ad tech. So I thought I'd just bring it to the forefront.
So true. Make it real. Absolutely.
I don't know why you're laughing, Matt. You're next.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah, get scared.
So, yes, I've already introduced him, but also joining me this week is ExchangeWire's senior editor and also the proud owner of a pair of authentic Dutch clogs, which I'm sure he's really regretting telling me, is Matt Broughton. Hello, Matt.
I have zero regrets at all about telling you those. They are snazzy, they are surprisingly comfortable, and I never get lost at parties because I sound like a shire horse when wearing them. They're fantastic.
Excellent. So you do wear them, you've worn them more than once, I take it.
Oh, absolutely.
This is going to be my next question. So it's one thing you owning a pair of authentic Dutch clogs. That's probably the key term there.
Authentic Dutch clogs, TM.
TM, there you go. But you also actually wear them out in public.
The reason I got them is for a Eurovision party.
Why shouldn't I be surprised by any of this?
Exactly.
Excellent. Wonderful. Well, thank you both so much for joining me this week. I'm just going to go straight into our first story, which is that Google is facing a €25 billion lawsuit in the UK and EU over digital advertising. So regulators in the UK and the EU have accused Google of anti-competitive behaviour in the digital advertising market, serving the tech giant with a €25 billion lawsuit. The California-based company faces accusations of abusing its position as a key player in ad tech by coordinating ad auctions between publishers and advertisers in alignment with its own interests, costing businesses up to £7 billion. The lawsuit is not the only legal headache for Google this week, as the tech giant failed to turn in a €4 billion fine imposed by the EU for using its Android operating system to stifle rivals. So, Lindsay, I'm going to come to you first on this. Do you think that this lawsuit is going to make any kind of impact on Google's operations, or is this just kind of business as usual for Google?
I think this lawsuit is the biggest lawsuit that they have encountered to date, where it's sort of a combined lawsuit between a Dutch company and a UK company, of course. And I think that maybe in isolation, yes, it will have a huge impact because obviously everyone's talking about it. But I think this combined with other lawsuits going on, I think only this week South Korea have imposed a penalty against both Google and Meta. The EU have upheld its original lawsuit about Google being anti-competitive in 2018 this year, saying that was a €4.1 billion lawsuit or something. So I think that this also, with everything that the DOJ is doing in the US as well, will have to cause Google to do something. They've already talked about, because of the stuff happening with DOJ, they've already talked about potentially spinning out the DoubleClick arm of Google, if you will. Not selling it, which is what everyone wants them to do, but spinning it out and kind of sticking it under the Alphabet umbrella. So the operations wouldn't sit in Google, they'd sit in Alphabet, but it would still be run with the same CEO. Will the DOJ accept this? I don't think they should, because I don't really see what difference it makes. But I think that this next lawsuit, which interestingly, you know, obviously is rooted in supporting publishers, and from the UK side of the lawsuit is an opt-out thing. So every publisher is automatically included in the lawsuit, and then in the Dutch version, it's opt-in. I think it's an expansion of other things that governments have tried to do. For example, what Australia tried to do, what France tried to do, what Spain tried to do by banning Google News, saying that it's not supporting publishers and taking revenues from them, which are unnecessary and unfair. You know, Google have stifled publishers for so long, and this will really kind of help to remind people of the power that can be brought back to them if they're able to take control of their own destiny, which with arguably Google as part of the mix, they can't. But I think as well, we need to remember that this could start regulatory warfare. That is the right way to control a monopoly by just coming at them in from every single possible angle? Maybe it is. Maybe there's no other way of really kind of getting Google to understand just how much of a problem they are, because obviously they staunchly deny and staunchly oppose any lawsuit brought against them. They're very, very against the latest one from the two law firms in the UK and in the Netherlands, and the same. They're disappointed with South Korea, disappointed with Europe. You know, when aren't they? So either this will cause great changes, or fines will be a huge part of their P&L. Basically, and they'll have to just accept that and move on with fines upheld. I think one of the law firms involved in this, I forget which one it is, I think it might be the UK one, their success rate is 74%, which is pretty damn good. So, you know, they could stand a chance of getting something out of Google, but it remains to be seen, you know, what will happen with that. And we also must remember, it is going to be slow. You know, it's taken 4 years for the EU to uphold their original fine of Google in 2018. So an actual lawsuit of this scale will take a long, long time to actually get anywhere. So I'm not sure how quickly we'll see anything if anything happens in the first place.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And Matt, what do you think? Do you think, because Google's this week, it seems like they're just accumulating fine after fine after fine, and seemingly not complying with regulators to turn in those fines. What do you think this says really about Google? Do you think they are going to, is there going to be any change to their operations?
Yeah, I completely agree with Lindsay's points. I think firstly, just in terms of the scale of the fine, a lot of the fines we've seen more recently have been more in the scale of, you know, between $50 and $100 million, which to companies the size of Google and Meta, it's not necessarily that big. They're pretty much rounding errors. 25 billion euros, that's not a rounding error. So obviously, if this legal action is successful, it's you know, going to have a meaningful and tangible effect. And as well, obviously, as Lindsay said, we're seeing a lot of other cases. And the fact that the 4.1 billion euro fine against Google, that was upheld, it shows that these cases are not only going ahead, but they're standing up to scrutiny. And I think that's what's critical in any regulatory action. To, you know, obviously for them to have that effect. I think the, you know, the difference between the EU and the UK in terms of the opt-in, in terms of UK and opt out in EU, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out and how many publishers are willing to go forward in the EU to complain against Google. But it's encouraging that the UK law firm is anticipating that they're going to reach out to many thousands of companies. So they're not just looking at the larger publishers, because obviously these allegations have a huge impact on the smaller publishers as well. Looking a bit deeper in terms of the firms that are, you know, supporting these legal claims, one of them is an economics consultancy called Charles River Associates. They've got a robust portfolio of work examining ad tech, and they've got previous work supporting independent ad tech, namely its successful advising of Criteo in a lawsuit against Meta with the French Competition Authority. So that's encouraging, because a lot of, you know, the government agencies, they're trying to have to learn ad tech on the fly, whereas to have these advisors with a bit more knowledge and a bit more nous in ad tech will help these legal cases to proceed. We were lucky enough to hear insight from Charles River Associates VP Michael Irvé for our recent research report we ran with Equitive on European ad servers. And that shows a really nice insight into how they're approaching the case and how they're looking at how Google has, you know, kind of run its ad stack in terms of that, you know, alleged dual self-preferencing, which has already been found guilty of with the French Competition Authority, and the kind of opacity around Google's practices, and, you know, publisher fears of losing demand if they move away from the Google ad stack, which is kind of things we've been saying more anecdotally in the industry for a number of years. But to actually have that down on paper in a concrete legal case, I think is definitely notable.
Google, we're coming for you. Everyone's coming for you.
We're coming to get you, Google. Just a question really for both of you. I think you've kind of both touched upon this, but do you feel like this is a turning point for Google and for ad tech in terms of big tech's dominance, or do you think that still remains to be seen?
I think this is a very big turning point. I it's so hard to know what the outcome will be, but this hasn't happened before, and I really want it to be a turning point. I want it to scare Google. You know, if they've got enough lawsuits coming at them, how are their legal team going to cope and make sure they're saying the right things and the right people are not kind of, you know, like cross-referencing themselves and saying the wrong thing? But something of this scale and this size, basically representing all publishers in two nations, will hopefully encourage other, because, you know, every other nation that has a publisher is also affected negatively by Google. So it could encourage more lawsuits of this scale to come on board as well. You know, class action lawsuits can be, you know, can be very, very effective and very, very powerful. I'm fascinated by this. And I think that it could change the way that the other big walled gardens operate as well. I don't know, but maybe we'll see more lawsuits for them too. And that would be another interesting aspect, certainly Meta.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think it's, you know, in hindsight, it'll be, you know, wonderful to see whether, you know, the legal action is successful. Normally, when legal action takes place at the same time as government investigations, it's a bit like, oh no, is one of them going to prejudice the other? Are they going to go, oh, they've already had legal action against them, so we're going to water down proposals in future? Or if, you know, the governments find, okay, you know, these big tech companies haven't been as awful as we've been saying they are. It could obviously, you know, work against legal action. But I think in this case, it's very much the legal action is looking at the kind of past damages that Google have done and are getting publishers their, you know, rightful reparations for that. Whereas the government investigations, they're looking more in terms of the future to kind of, you know, restructure these organizations to make sure that they don't have this monopolistic power going forward.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. That's a really interesting point, actually, Matt. And actually, they've all slightly nuanced in what they're going after. Like the EU is going after the specific fact of Android and pre-install apps on phones. Like if you're pre-installing your own apps, not allowing other people to have access, like that makes you a monopoly. And obviously what the DOJ are going after is something completely different. And this specific class action lawsuit is around the publisher aspect. So if they can all stick to their nuances and not go too broad, it could make exactly the challenge you said could happen, hopefully water that down a bit.
Yeah, it'll be very interesting to see as the process goes on whether we see, for example, US law firms joining in with this lawsuit or ones across Asia joining in, whether it's just, you know, as with GDPR, the UK and the EU are kind of at the forefront and then those other markets catch up after. But yeah, it'll be hugely interesting to see what their take on this legal action is.
Yeah, absolutely. So potential for a domino effect, potentially. Said it again.
How about again? Potentially?
Potentially, yes. Potentially, perhaps, maybe. Great chat on that, but I think I'm going to take us through to our second story of the week, is that Meta has disbanded its responsible innovation team. So Facebook parent Meta has called time on its responsible innovation team, which comprised of over 20 staff, including a mix of engineers and ethicists, who worked alongside Meta's product teams and external privacy specialists to identify and resolve potential issues with Facebook and Instagram. Eric Porterfield, Communications Director, Social Impact at Meta, commented that the firm remains committed to the goals behind the responsible innovation team, but that its resources would be better placed invested in issue-specific teams. So I think, Matt, I'll come to you first on this. What do you think Meta's decision to basically can the responsible innovation team says about Meta's outlook on their own responsibility?
I mean, the optics of this aren't great, are they? I mean, Meta's reputation for doing the right thing ethically is for several years has been in the toilet. You know, we've had various scandals, Cambridge Analytica and the Francis Hogan revelations are just two examples of that. But also, I think now at this time, Meta's corporate reputation is under fire. Over the last year, its share price has plummeted around 60%, and that's significantly more than its contemporaries. So Google, theirs has gone down 26%, Apple's has risen 5%. And I'm just going to go back to a quote from Francis Hogan saying, "Facebook over and over again has shown it chooses profit over safety." And I think there could be a little bit of that to, you know, kind of counter that point. Meta's going for a quite hefty corporate restructuring at the moment. This week, there's been a very interesting merger between its internal content moderation teams, essentially merging its teams for ads and user posts. So they're now going to be treated the same in terms of that content moderation. And ultimately, we are talking about a loss of a team of 20 compared to Meta's overall headcount of over 85,000. So it always stank a little bit of tokenism for that team to be there in the first place. I think, you know, in the ideal world, if Meta's designing new products or adapting its existing products, you know, with ethics and privacy in mind, that needs to be done by the product teams themselves and be a more, you know, organic and intrinsic process rather than having this poor snowed under team of 20 trying to manage all those products from a more external point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. Lindsay, what do you think?
So, I mean, you can always trust Matt to come in with some good quotes and stats and be over prepared. I mean, I read this story and my first thought was, this is a bit of a non-story, or it would be if it weren't Meta, because Matt, you're absolutely right. The optics here were not good. But to kind of, I guess, play devil's advocate here slightly, I don't like to because it's Meta, but, you know, I will try. It is very common to create like a working group, if you like, that focuses on a specific industry issue and is tasked over a period of time to try and fix that issue within the broader company. And the intention of these working groups is often to get to a stage where it becomes almost intrinsic and endemic within the broader company. And the role of that team is, my work here is done. You've all done a great job. I can now go and play some games and not do any more work. So I kind of feel like that's actually probably what's happening, because they talk about the fact that, you know, there are certain things they've achieved, like ensuring that in the some dating product they have, I didn't even know they had a dating product, like, what the hell? They remove the option to select which race you want to define which race, and then other dating apps have apparently followed suit, according to Meta. So things like that, and kind of looking at product development from an ethical first standpoint and not a profit first standpoint, you know, completely contrary to the Francis Hogan quote you just read out there, Matt. I do think that the intention probably was always to ensure that they can have the ethics part of product development just happen intrinsically within the broader engineering and product development teams. So I'm hoping that that's basically what it is, and that many of the people in that team will be absorbed into the various teams going forward. They haven't confirmed if they will or won't be, but that's kind of what I would expect to happen. And like I said, in my opinion, if it were any other company, it would be a bit of a non-story, because Meta is so terrible at this kind of stuff. Everyone goes, oh, well, that's that then. They only had it a couple of years and decided that no, ethicism is completely out of their remit. Not bothered. Goodbye.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious to consider why this has happened now. I do agree with you, Lindsay, that if any other company, we'd kind of shrug our shoulders. But Meta, I think, when I first read it, the first kind of thought I had was, I'm not surprised, I'm just disappointed. But, you know, Meta's
like an angry parent.
Yeah, pretty much.
He's not angry, just disappointed.
I am just disappointed. I don't know what I expected. I expected nothing, and yet I was still let down. But it's curious to think about why they've done this now. Why have they chosen to disband their responsible innovation team at this point in time?
Yeah, I think it kind of, you know, they're doing a lot of, like I said, a lot of corporate restructuring at the moment. We've obviously previously discussed how it's trying to turn Instagram more into a TikTok-esque app. Like I said, I'm quite interested to go back to that merging of the content moderation teams, because you'd have thought ostensibly, right, ads are going to be quite different from user posts. There's going to be a bit more kind of moderation on the brand side in terms of what creative they're using. But to have those teams kind of merged into one is interesting. I'm not sure in terms of the machinations of that, how that's going to play out. So I think if they are just doing a bit more restructuring, then, you know, to merge this team of 20 at the same time, I think it's easier for them to do it all in one go rather than do this restructuring of the content moderation teams. They've also shut down Facebook Gaming as a standalone app. So obviously there's going to be a bit of reshifting in terms of there, which I find interesting in and of itself, because you'd have thought, you know, gaming has always been touted as the entryway into the metaverse. I thought metaverse was going to be Facebook's strategy going forward. They changed their name, for goodness sake. And, you know, Facebook Gaming got a huge leg up when Microsoft closed Mixer and basically just gave all the customers all the data to Facebook Gaming. So I think that's obviously going to, I mean, the few Mixer customers that actually stayed on, that's going to annoy them. It's just like, oh, we moved to this platform and now you're shutting down this platform. You know, they've said it's going to be, you know, more within the Facebook site itself, but I think it's a bit of an error to shut down that standalone app, because I think gamers do enjoy that outside experience rather than just, oh God, I've got to be locked into the Facebook platform.
No one wants to be locked into the Facebook platform.
No, and Facebook should be smart enough, Meta, whatever, should be smart enough to recognise that to a degree, I think. Like, you know, we talked earlier about if Google sold DoubleClick and put it under the Alphabet app and not the Google app, Google umbrella, not app, I can't even speak, ignore me, I'm very tired. But like, in terms of breaking it up, you don't want everything to be Facebook, Facebook, Facebook. You want to be able to use the products standalone and forget that you're part of this horrendous umbrella of companies and forget that your data is being used across all of them. But you're right, from a gaming perspective, like, you'd want to keep it very, very separate. And it's surprising they haven't done that, actually.
Yeah, lots to talk about, really, there with Meta, which I guess is kind of, that's just Meta, really. Could talk about them for hours, I think. But I will take us on to our third story of the week, which is that Roblox is moving it towards advertising. So at its annual developer conference, gaming giant Roblox announced plans to debut ads on the platform, moving beyond its traditional virtual goods and services and diversifying into the ad market. The platform, which boasts over 52 million users worldwide, is planning to experiment with its own ad format portals. Despite its size, the company has endured a tough year. Revenue growth has slowed to 30%, and the company revealed that it relies on the sale of virtual currency Robux for substantially all of our revenue. Chief Product Officer Manuel Bronstein said, "We have an amazing transactional economy and we will continue to invest in it." Bronstein characterised the company's push into online ads as a good strategic bet that's early in development. So, Lindsay, I'm going to come to you first on this one. Do you think that Roblox moving towards advertising is proving ground for the metaverse?
I think I do actually think it could be. I think it's interesting. I mean, there's a lot of interesting points to make about Roblox going down this route. And I think from a metaverse perspective, or certainly from their metaverse, which I know doesn't make sense because the metaverse is one giant thing, but kind of their little corner of the metaverse, if you like, they've been relying on selling goods and services, virtual goods and services, using Robux, using virtual currency. And it makes a lot of sense that they would go down alternative monetization routes, diversify their revenue. Certainly in the kind of the turbulent world we live in, they need to find other sources of revenue. It makes sense. Advertising is an obvious route to market. And I think that given the world in which Roblox exists, from my perspective, which I must caveat, listener, I know sod all about because I'm not 13 years old. it makes sense for advertising to be part of that. But of course, given the world that Roblox exists in, it won't be advertising as people like me know it in kind of just normal kind of gaming apps. It will still be metaverse related. So, you know, it'll be something like digital billboards or that kind of thing. A bit like what you might get if you're playing like FIFA and you see kind of the hoardings around the side of the stadium. But these will be interactive, of course, and you'd be able to probably click on them, use them as coupons, whatever. And that for me is fascinating because it's not just about getting money from brands for advertising. It is about gamification. And that is what is still so missing in advertising in the gaming world. And something that I think is such a lost opportunity for big brands, for any brand who don't understand gaming, the gaming consumer, the gaming universe. Like, there's so much opportunity. I think they did a test with Warner Brothers. Already. And if you can get brands like that engaged in advertising in this capacity, I think it would be fascinating. And they will be able to engage with a different type of audience. But the most important thing is working closely with Roblox to understand who the audience is and what they would be interested in. The other challenge, of course, there is that it's that Roblox is very kid-friendly, and most of these ads will not be kid-sensitive, will not be kid-suitable, and the kids can't interact with them. What they need here is something like Super Awesome, which obviously is not going to help them because they're owned by... Is it Epic they're owned by, Matt?
Yes, I believe Epic. So
not, but something like Super Awesome would be perfect because that is literally kid-friendly ad tech. It's kid tech. That's the kind of thing they need to ensure they can actually show the right ads to kids too. Because given their audience is so young, you know, you'd argue kind of, can they make advertising work for that audience if it's such a young audience, many of whom they can't actually legally advertise to based on kind of current requirements from the platform? So there's a lot to unpick there. But in terms of your first question about, is it the proving ground for the metaverse? I think it's a proving ground for advertising within a metaverse, advertising some in a virtual environment and then turning that into something physical. That is the interesting bit. That is bringing the two worlds together, which is the thing that people aren't sure about. Like, no, people don't want to own, well, children do. I don't, and our adults do, I guess, too. I don't want to own a virtual dress. I want to own a real dress. I don't really wear dresses. This is a bad example. But you get my meaning. Like, how can you connect the two? And that, I think, is what is missing in terms of understanding. So advertising in that capacity, and Matt will be able to explain this much better than I, because he understands, he has a gaming head on him and I do not. But that, I think, is for me as a consumer, the missing link. And that, I think, is what will make advertising in the Roblox environment very, very, very interesting, if they can get brands to gamify it and promote their wares in the right way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Matt, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm going to, you know, again, go sort of through my points and echo Lindsay in a lot of them. Initially, when I read this, it was kind of thought, oh, this is similar to what Netflix is doing, what The Athletic is doing, what Uber's doing, what a host of other companies are doing. Economic conditions have got more challenging. Revenue diversification has been bumped up the list. Companies now are exploring ads where previously they were a bit more hesitant on them. I think it's different to the likes of Netflix in that Roblox has been offering these kind of brand experiences for a fair while now, so it's able to hit the ground running a little quicker than perhaps Netflix will. It's surprising how long it's taken them to get here. Like, even before they IPO'd, everyone knew that Roblox, vast majority of their money was coming in through in-game purchases through its Roblox currency. But as Lindsay mentioned, on the flip side, the controls and legal obligations for advertising to children are much stricter than those for adults. So that possibly explains why they've been a little slower getting there. But I still think there's a lot of fluff when it comes to the metaverse. There's a quote from the article where it said, Bronstein speculated that future ads in the metaverse, an online world where people socialize, work and learn, could resemble digital billboards that people can use to buy goods like shoes or even branded digital coffee cups. He's basically just described display advertising, an online world, read the internet. It's very similar to that. So I think we kind of need to move away from, everyone's jumped on metaverse as a description for this, but I think this is more like an, you know, in-game advertising version 2.0 or advanced in-game advertising, because as Lindsay said, there's so much opportunity here in terms of that immersion, and the angle to, you know, of spending in-game currency for a coupon for a real-world item, that's one that's hugely interesting to explore. We've been talking a lot in ExchangeWire about retail media and how loyalty schemes are a huge part of that, and that kind of closing the loop between marketing efforts and actual sales. So I think that's something that is hugely exciting and should be explored. But I think to tag it with the metaverse will probably turn a lot of people off, because they're just going to think, oh, this is just more, you know, low quality, you know, early stage. You know, metaverse advertising could very much take off, but it's still very early stage. So I think if people actually described it as advanced in-game advertising, for example, I think that could be a lot more enticing.
So you kind of touched upon this earlier, Matt, that, you know, in-game advertising isn't anything new. However, because of, you know, Roblox's status as a gaming giant, do you think that this is somewhat of a turning point, or does this open a lot of new opportunities for in-game advertising?
Yeah, I think definitely. I think what Roblox has, it has massive scale. It has a young audience, which obviously I've touched upon. It's difficult to advertise to that audience. But if you're able to do it successfully and with controls that, you know, are in place, obviously we've seen, you know, the rapid rise of TikTok, which does have a younger audience, and obviously the appeal there. The other thing it has, it's, you know, this more immersive and freeform platform, whereas, you know, a lot of games, a lot of environments, they're a bit more kind of on rails. They're, you know, you're a bit set in what you can do with it. Obviously, I used possibly quite harshly the display advertising example earlier. And, you know, the vast majority of web pages, they're quite static. Whereas with Roblox, you're able to, you know, go in and have these, you know, craft these worlds, create games within games. There's a lot more you can do with it. And I think that kind of immersive advertising, I think platforms such as Roblox, I think that's something they can explore, and obviously offer advertisers something new. And we've already seen, in terms of the, you know, activations they've done already with brands, they've been received well. I think Taco Bell have done one. I think it's either Taco Bell or one American fast food giant.
I think it was Taco Bell or Chipotle.
Yes,
could have been Chipotle during Halloween, I think.
Yes. And yeah, obviously you were able to go in and buy in-game items, but also that would get you food in the real world. You could get, you know, print off a voucher or a coupon code. And it's just, I think, especially in this environment, it's offering advertisers something new. And yeah, it could be a precursor to metaverse advertising. Like I said, it needs more development in terms of the metaverse itself, or metaverses, and just the definitions around that. But it could definitely prove a turning point.
I think also, just to point out that an article I read about this on CNBC was that, you know, it said Roblox is jumping into online ads during a period of turbulence in the industry. Other companies like Meta and Snap have been hurt by Apple's privacy changes in iOS. You know, why would Roblox want to go down that route at this time? I think the thing to remember about this is that, because Roblox haven't done advertising before in the traditional sense of the word, there's no legacy advertising or tracking or targeting setup in the advertising world for them to have to try and adapt into the new world. They can build everything from scratch. They're big enough to be able to build, to buy, to get the right people in. And I think that they're not going to be affected by privacy changes as much as other of the big companies, you know, like the Kings of the world, the Epics of the world, because there was no platform system, advertising system in place already. They're building one from scratch, building it purely to deal with the current status of iOS and Android privacy, or mobile privacy more generally, which I think is also interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And if it's more, you know, these kind of experiences within the game and these dedicated worlds within the game, you know, that is opt-in users 101. Users will only visit that world if they're interested in the brand and interested in the product, rather than, you know, one of the traditional drawbacks of in-game advertising. Oh, this is distracting from the core game experience. This is going to turn users off. Whereas users who are interested in a fast food coupon, they're going to go to that world or that in-game platform. So yeah, I think engagement there will be quite a lot higher than a lot of other in-game activations, I feel.
So that brings us to the end of this week's podcast. Matt, Lindsay, thank you very much for joining me this week. And thank you for listening. We'll be back with a new episode of the MadTech podcast this time next week. But in the meantime, you can find the latest news and developments in AdTech on our website and in the Stack, our weekly roundup of hot topics in the industry. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.